Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to After Things. I'm Bryce Castillo, your host, as always, here on the show. Joined with Brian Brushwood.
Yes, who has also always been here.
Always here. And Justin Robert Young.
Ah, yes. This is my first day, and I look forward to making a deep and rich friendship with all of you.
This is the podcast all about being a creative professional and some of the behind-the-scenes stuff, the different things that we work on. We got an email from a listener. I wanted to get into this first. I know this is a little bit of writing oriented, but I think all three of us could maybe sniff this out. I think this is more of a sniffing thing than a writing thing.
Ah, the sniff test.
So we got an email from Ken. Ken writes, "So I've got a script in my drawer and I'm wondering if I should send it into a screenwriting contest. There's a $39 entry fee or an optional $108 to get feedback. I suspect that when they're reviewing contest stories that they're looking for ways to eliminate scripts as quickly and efficiently as possible. So theoretically, you could get rejected for formatting your cover page incorrectly. Do you think it's worth the extra $69 to learn why you were rejected? Do you think these contests are worth bothering with at all? When you were starting out, did you or would you enter a magic writing or comedy or podcast, whatever, competition? And would you pay extra for feedback? And how do you tell if a competition is legit and worth your hard-earned loons?" That's from Ken.
Justin... Let me give you my gut check and you can tell me if it resonates with you.
Sure.
My gut says that when I was starting in magic, this kind of thing would be rejected out of hand, but truthfully, it would be rejected because I didn't have the resources. 20 years later, money looks different to me now. And it basically depends on what does money mean to you? Because truthfully, I would say that the most valuable thing is a commitment to iterating and writing many, many scripts and having them be rejected here, there, and everywhere, and eventually becoming a award-winning screenwriter or whatever. But if you have money, then what is the point of taking the long way around if you could get at least some feedback? And it seems like, you know, somebody spending their time, it's not the worst thing on the planet if they were to be compensated for their time as they looked at your art.
Yeah. The first thing that kind of struck me with that email is that there is a lot of looking for the no, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of looking for the permission to say, no, I don't want to do this, which, like, if you're looking for that, then it kind of makes me think that you are kind of into doing this, but you just don't want to deal with whatever might come of it, or you are recognizing the pitfalls. I don't think an adult, you know, if this is something that really brings you creative happiness, whether or not you want to make it your full-time gig, but even more so if you do, then, you know, what's the extra, what is it, $60 or whatever? Like, yeah. You know, that seems, for somebody with a full-time job, like, yeah. The difference between entering it and the difference between getting feedback, like, is fine. The biggest thing that I would say is, like, I would do it just because if you do want to make this more of your life, like, the initial ideas of, like, oh, I'm going to dip, if I dip my toe in the water, will it be cold? Do not, they pale in comparison to the horrors that lay before you of more complex, multi-layered rejection. These are the things that are in place so the people who care the most get in and the people that are willing to quit stay out.
That's a really good parallel because in Hollywood, they'll still reject you just as hard, but they won't do the service of telling you the truth as to why. Like, no. If you could pay money to get the truth as to why you were rejected out of hand, seems like that might be worth the money.
And when it comes to he says this is a screenwriting contest. Screenwriting, even script writing, has very specific, stringent formatting, right? Like he mentions, like, you know, if my cover page doesn't look right, they may reject it out of hand, and that's a reality of it. Is that the way that you format stuff? You know, outside of how well you wrote whatever your concept is, you wrote, like, the actual technical element of it, which is putting it together in the right way, is important and says, you know, it colors whatever the piece that you've written. So if you have something poorly formatted, it could be great, but with because there's such a deluge of ideas and scripts out there, if it doesn't even look right, they're going, other people, real people will reject it. And so I think at least from a technical level, that would be a good thing to know, that you are at least, you know, putting the words on the paper the right way.
I mean, sure. But even beyond that, the next level about honing your craft is understanding what feedback to take and what feedback not to.
Yeah.
And so, like, even if it's not great feedback, understanding that as you go forward, that it's not great feedback is so worthwhile. Like, every thing that you learn at any, especially at the beginning of a stage of trying to hone a craft, man, it is invaluable. And yeah, I know, Brian, you've been a part of Magic competitions, certainly in your younger days. I was part of sketch comedy competitions.
Have you paid to enter those competitions historically?
You pay to go to the convention, and so you already have some kind of sunk cost, and then you certainly fear getting on stage and sucking. Sure. And so there are stakes,
but there's not a direct fee, basically.
Correct, but I sure. do think there is value to a commitment device, because think about this. Like, he says he's got a script in his drawer, mm-hmm. and wants to know if you send it. I'll tell you this much: if you don't enter it in the contest, and if you don't put $100-something on the line, you have no incentive to say, is this formatted correctly? What are the sure. things that are wrong with
drawer.
This? Whereas, like, once you put money on the line, that commitment device will cause you to say, like, okay, well, if I'm going to spend $100 for feedback, I don't want to get called out on technical fouls. Mm-hmm. So I'm gonna do my due diligence. I'm gonna make sure it's formatted correctly. And guess what? You're learning. So the mere fact that you put money on the line causes you to commit to be like, not today, Satan. I'm gonna get real good opinions, or I'm gonna decide that. Yeah, I'm going to put myself in a position where if anybody doesn't love this, I know that they're the ones who have a problem, not me.
Yeah.
And I think there's value to that.
Yeah, we were part. So the sketch comedy troupe went out to Chicago. So there was certainly, I mean, I don't know if we paid to get into or paid to submit. We probably paid to submit, because most comedy festivals you do pay to submit. But we certainly did pay as 20-somethings with no money to fly out to from New York City to Chicago. And we performed at this, like, late night thing that was like a competition where we had judges, and the judges would give us, like, live on stage feedback. So it was kind of like a reality show, and we crushed with the audience and then just got decimated by the judges.
Wow.
On stage. And it was like, it was one of our best sketches, but it involved, like, random out of nowhere singing. That was like, we thought it was kind of funny that none of us were professional singers, but the subject matter was so silly and it was like a musical from out of nowhere. So we felt it could kind of carry, but looking back on that feedback, it was good feedback, but, like, man, did it suck to get it while there was a hot light on you and you're in your early 20s and you were filled with all of those hormones and pride and everything. Yeah. Like, it sucked. And I'm very glad it happened.
Yeah.
Because it is forever. I just know nothing's really going to be as bad as that. Nothing's going to be as bad as, like, going up in front of a bunch of strangers, them cheering for you, winning the crowd, then having an authority step out and explain, no, that was a bad sketch. And then the audience is just dead. Like, the guy, like, stripped the audience's love from us and then dismissed us off the stage. And then we're like, all right, well, I guess we're going to fly back to New York tomorrow.
Yeah.
Anyway, see you later. But
yeah.
It was an important experience, though.
Yeah. Those moments are not great, but almost always there's real value that comes from them. I've told the story of having somebody throw fruit at my stage, and I was like, why did that happen? And I realized, and I had a long time to think about it. I had a 5-hour drive with
a long fruit shower.
I had 5 hours of driving in the mountains of West Virginia where I couldn't even get radio. This is pre-internet, pre-smartphone. So I had nothing but to think about, why did they hate my show so much? And then on the other side, I came out with a very strong resolve to never – again, do a show where the audience was not effectively primed to know that what they were getting into. Because very clearly, the answer was that they thought they were seeing a traditional stage illusion magic show, mm-hmm. and instead they got this subvertive, you know, angry energy against cruise ship tricky men, and that was not what they were primed to expect. Sure. And so from that, you know, I immediately went and put together pre-show videos and intro video, and I decided to take music cues out of the hands of tech because they always screwed them up and it always made me look bad. And there was a drive out of that misery that fueled a decade of success in the college market, because everything was to a chrome-like polish because I trusted nobody but myself on everything.
Yeah. And I think going back to what you guys mentioned, you know, the amount of money is cosmically small, and the stakes are smaller than you know, kind of your anecdotes here, getting fruit thrown at you on stage or doing a rather successful sketch and then kind of being shot down. This screenwriting contest is surely lower stakes than that.
Yeah, I guess the question he's really asking is, mm-hmm. do you sign up to raise the stakes, knowing that you're just going to spend money just so that you could be more frustrated? And that's a counterintuitive thing to do. But I would say maybe you do. Maybe, many of these things are scam, and maybe the advice is not garbage, but the stakes. Or maybe the advice is garbage, but the stakes are not garbage, right?
I have known a lot of people, smart, creative, amazing people, who have outthought stupid scams that would involve them creatively extending themselves beyond their comfort zone. They have spotted it. Man, oh, clearly, look. And I'll tell you what, even more, when you Google the people who started its names, they used to be working at this other thing. Oh, my God. Can you believe they actually used to work with these people? Oh, wow. Good thing I didn't spend my $40. And then that's it. Congratulations. You won the snooping game as to whether or not you should submit. Now, whether or not you do will have no bearing on you actually crossing the threshold that you need to, which is, I'm willing to take risks. I'm willing to theoretically put $40 in the hand of a scammer if it means that I am extending myself and I am getting my art out there, because that's what this world is. This world is constantly going to people that you should not trust. And and if you think that problem is interesting, wait till the money gets bigger, the possible fame gets bigger. Wait until these things are not a decision that you can make in your underwear on a web portal, but rather extend months and months and months and months of your life.
Wait until somebody asks you if you want to come out and dance on a reality dance show competition. And you sit there and you think that everything in you doesn't want to do this at all. But really, at your heart of hearts, the only reason you're saying no is because you're afraid. And the moment you realize that you're afraid, and then that's the exact reason you should do it. Look, man, raise the stakes. I think there's a lot of good that comes from that.
I would say go for it. But then again, I think the cost of making mistakes, the cost of you literally lighting that $60 on fire, especially at this phase of where you're going, trying to get to where you're going, is well worth it if it means that you took a concrete step forward.
Yeah. So I hope that helped, Ken. Brian, last weekend, or this past weekend, you went to VidCon, the big YouTube content creation convention conference.
Yeah.
How was that?
10th anniversary. I'd heard about it for a long time. I knew that like 20,000, 25,000 people showed up at it. Mm-hmm. I'd always asked people who went to VidCon, like, hey, what's the takeaway? Do you do a lot of business out there? And they are like, well, not so much, but if you've never experienced, you know, connecting with your fans or feeling recognized and famous, it's pretty great. And I was like, well, I mean, I tour with the stage show, so I've experienced that a lot. And so I never went, but my 11-year-old wanted to go as a fan. And I was like, well, if I'm going to go, then, you know, I'll do the dad experience. But let me reach out and see if what opportunities there are. And fun fact, my old boss from Revision 3 is running the show.
Jim Lauterbach,
yeah. And so I made it clear. It's like, hey, man, I'm doing this for my daughter, but if there's anything I could do. And there wasn't really a natural fit, especially because it was so late in the game to plug me in. Although I would love, I'm going to reach out to him immediately and volunteer my services and talks for whatever he wants to plug me into next year. Because of the...
You had a good time then.
2.5 days, I spent most of it just being super dad to Josie. But I went to maybe like 3 or 4 panels or presentations, and they were much more valuable than I would have expected going into it. I thought it was really worthwhile. I had the opportunity to meet with sponsors and potential sponsors, but one of the things that really stuck out to me is they had a fireside chat with the something global content development for Twitter, and it made me think of your friend of mine, Ali Spagnola, and about how she's crushing it with these mashups that, that she's doing on Twitter. Yeah, you've seen these, Justin, right?
Of course, it's like the YouTube series that she then posts like the songs themselves on Twitter,
Well, and Twitter increasingly is making itself not a conduit to link you to where the stuff is, but instead the destination itself. And to see Ali embrace that, because it used to, traditionally I've used Twitter to say, hey, there's a thing over here on this YouTube channel. There's a thing over here on this other place. But Ali has been making sure that these videos are under 2 minutes long and is able to just have it to where you get the full enjoyment out of it. And the real beauty of Twitter is, unlike YouTube, on YouTube, once you post a video, you get one 48-hour window where you show up in the new feed for all your subscribers, assuming the algorithm gives you the blessing. After that, it would be extraordinary and awful for you to try to get away with posting that video a second time. Whereas, like posting the exact same video for the purpose of showing up in their new feed again. Whereas Twitter, there's no expectation in this fire hose that you're not going to post things multiple times. So as a result, when she has a new one of these videos, she posts it, and then she retweets the responses people are giving that in effect posts it all over again. And I think when I looked at it, it was like she had 500,000 views on one of her videos in less than 24 hours on Twitter. Right. And Twitter's introducing tools to monetize your content on there. So the idea of content with the intention of just going to live on Twitter is really engaging, especially because, that back catalog of scam school tricks, you know, all those tricks are kind of primed and ready to be reshot for various reasons, including updating the content. But they're short enough that I almost wonder if some kind of revisiting all that stuff just for the intention of putting it and monetizing it on Twitter might not be worth doing. But there's a number of steps that need to happen in between them. First of all, the Twitter Media Studio, I think, is the name of the program that allows you to monetize your content. And that's all stuff I'll have to learn. But
because there's a business side. It's like the 2 minute, 20 second video limit for Twitter. That's for normies. If you have a longer thing, you can post a longer thing. You just have to be a business. It's probably through that media suite, but there's a means through that already.
And I think that's something that I hadn't recognized the breadth of real estate that we're sitting on the YouTube or on the Twitter channel. I mean, it's as big almost as the or maybe even
your
bigger.
At Schwood account.
Twitter.com/Schwood is at as big. I mean, I threw a stick for Kepler for 20 minutes and got 20,000 views, it's one of those moments that you realize. In the presentation, they talked about a sponsorship deal they did with the folks who do We Rate Dogs, right? So they bring the guy out, and the guy says, it's not a complicated formula. Basically, everyone sends us pictures of dogs. We pick one. We always give it a rating of higher than 10 out of 10, and we say something nice about a dog, and the whole world loves it. And then Disney came and paid them what I imagine is a Matterhorn of money for 4 tweets about Dumbo. One where they rated Dumbo, one where they ask a question like, how would you rate Dumbo? And then 2 more things.
Sure.
But But that idea of, and all you have to do is add those magic three characters, pound AD for hashtag ad, mm-hmm. and then then you're legit. It in a world where speaking your mind earnestly on Twitter is increasingly a liability and not a benefit, it makes me really interested in looking at it as a platform destination for outputting content that we do.
Mm-hmm. I do look a little side-eyed at some of those numbers, or at least some of their metrics, right?
Oh, for the number of views?
Yeah, because Twitter does autoplay videos, which is actually, I went in and turned off autoplaying video just because at some point I was scrolling through my feed and just felt like, with like the new way that they've designed the site and how they prioritize, you know, videos and GIFs and stuff, it felt like a cacophony, basically. So I wonder... If they're doing the Facebook thing that Facebook got fined like $5 billion for.
Oh, did they? I didn't hear about them getting fined for it by the fake inflating all of their video views.
I think that was it, or that might have been the surveillance thing. But
that was another thing that they got the FTC fined for. But Facebook has definitely been embarrassed because they've inflated numbers.
Yeah. And so like this, like a similar thing with Periscope, right? I mean, I'm sure all of those views were real, but also this is Periscope, which is a smaller user base.
Well, and also probably come in for a few minutes and then leave.
Well, your Periscope notifications are a different checkbox on Twitter, and most people maybe have never cared about it or thought about it, and so that it's I don't know. It would be I would be interested to see if anything shakes out similarly about those, because I mean we've had that with Scam Nation videos where you know the short videos we've done do very well, but you know they're not monetized, they're not the full video. They're only a fraction of the thing. They're meant to get people to where we've been able to monetize on YouTube.
Right.
And so I don't know. It would be cool. I genuinely do like Twitter. I don't like the We Rate Dogs account very much, but
but again, I certainly like how much money it sounds like they made for four tweets, you know.
Uh-huh. But that's also like the PewDiePie, like that's a big
name
account, right? So I don't know. It would be interesting to look more into that. Were there any other topics that you cut a panel of?
Yeah. I mean, I saw individual people, which I don't know that there's much value in after things. Although sure. I will say one of the highlights was finding out that Veronica Belmont was there. So I guess first time I saw V in like 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
It's been forever. It was really a delight.
Was she doing the Adobe stuff there?
She was not. She was doing her talk on how to deal with online trolls.
Oh, nice.
And it was interesting because I was like, she was like, I'm about to go on. And then she immediately texted us in like, but don't come. I don't want you in the audience. I'll be nervous. So I'm like, all right. but it was just a joy. And I really look forward to moving early to try to be a part of next year. I think the VidCon experience, there's a lot of value in it. It was a lot of fun to connect and meet the YouTube ecosystem is so very siloed mm-hmm. that one of the best things on the planet was to have my 11-year-old explain to me how much more famous everybody else was than me. And then that gave me an instant in to talk to everybody. And it was a great collaborative experience that I look forward to participating next year.
It would be cool to set up a convention, because we've gone to a lot of conventions and stuff, but sometimes it's kind of by the seat of our pants or whatever. And like, especially somewhere at a VidCon where you could do a meetup if you were set up with enough time and give people a lot of notice, because I think that's the thing that these conventions want, you know, in return, is go and tell people you're going to be here.
Right.
And because a lot of times we just kind of get over there ASAP, that doesn't always gel with kind of what they want.
That was the only bummer, was because I wasn't on the program, because I wasn't officially part of it, there was no incentives for me to make a lot of noise about me being a VidCon.
Sure.
So I really was just Josie's dad at this thing. It would be fun to make a bit of a splash next year.
Yeah. Alrighty. Well, any after things picks? I'm trying to think. I feel like I had something.
Crawl. Go see Crawl. Alligators. They want to bite you.
My pick is Spider-Man Far From Home. I loved it. It might be my favorite Marvel movie. I'm just in love with this Spider-Man run. The fact that they've gotten two Spider-Man movies in and they have not even like sniffed the good villains, like, is amazing. I compared it on Twitter to like the Dark Knight's big villain being Clayface. But they've just captured, I mean, for both Vulture, I mean, considering Vulture was kind of a threadbare villain to my, at least as a fan, I never really connected much to him. They just invented this amazing, super captivating kind of backstory for Vulture. And for the villain in this movie, oh my God, is it everything I ever wanted in telling that kind of story? Because I do love that villain, and man, was it great. And also, not only was that movie really, really great, but it was so good that by the time I walked out of the theater, it had erased some of the damage that another Marvel movie that came out this year that isn't Endgame, which name escapes me, did to one of my favorite elements of the Marvel universe. It even repaired how they treated that element of the Marvel universe like trash garbage, and at least reestablished how rad they can be.
Oh, okay. I got to pick. I finished watching this because we got this as a recommendation on Cord Killers last week or the week before. It's a New Zealand show that Netflix got the rights to, The Casketeers. It's a reality-ish show about a family that runs a funeral home. And so you follow, you know, these funeral directors as they, you know, gather the bodies and get them prepared for funerals. And it's interesting because it is a reality show. So it's a mixture of like, here's real footage from the people going and working the funerals, and you see the families and you see the crying and you see the reaction, and, you know, you see a lot of different types of funerals because they deal with a lot of Pacific Island funerals. So Tongans and Maori people, you get to see a lot of that. And then there's always a B plot of that is very clearly like the reality show, massaging of it, right? Like, oh, this week there was a salesperson in and they showed us lighted caskets, and so we're gonna show everyone the caskets with the LED lights on them, and they get one, and oh, isn't that weird? It's got,
oh, it looks like it's
colors.
Floating.
Yeah. And that stuff, I get it. You know, it's meant to balance off the very heavy and very real emotional element. But sometimes it's just a little overly done. But it's very interesting to see and look at the way these different cultures deal with death and funerals. It is good. It's good. And it's kind of an easy, quick watch. I think the 12 seasons, two seasons, and it's like 12 or 14 episodes. So it's really neat. The Casketeers.
Cool.
On Netflix.
Nice.
Well, that's going to do it here for us at After Things. Thank you guys so much for listening. Thanks for joining me, Brian and Justin.
Oh, finally, for the first time, we all got together.
It's been after.
Goddamn right.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.